This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net to see our lineup of past speakers and upcoming speakers. Today our guest is Steve Elswick. Steve is the editor of Extraordinary Technology Magazine, and he organizes an annual Extraordinary Technology Conference in Salt Lake City. He is a diehard in this field. He's been around for years. He actually was the founder of the International Tesla Society, which is basically Tesla tech.info is the website that is a spinoff of that. And he compiles a lot of audiovisual type of materials from conferences held all over the place. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sterling. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. You have, like I said, you've been in this for many years. How many years is that exactly?
I've been involved in the alternative energy field since 1984.
What a year. Good thing George Orwell didn't. Was that Orwell? Who was the 1984 book? Who wrote that?
George Orwell.
Yeah, good thing that hasn't quite materialized by 1984, but we're well on our way, certainly, to the vision. Since 1984, you've been involved in this. You've seen a lot of things come and go. Before we get into talking about maybe what interests you the most, let's give a little promo for the upcoming conference in Salt Lake City. When is that and where?
Okay, we'll be in Salt Lake City at the college campus there, the Miller Center.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be July 26th through the July 29th. And we start on Thursday afternoon, and we run to Sunday about noon. Unless we have additional speakers, then we might extend it.
Mm-hmm. I've been to three of those now, 3 years in a row, and have had a great time each time. Of course, it's easier for me to go because I live just about half an hour away from the venue there at the Miller Free Enterprise Center, just off I-15. It's a fantastic conference, both the speakers and the people who attend. I was very impressed with the caliber of science, and you know, there's quite a few PhDs that show up at these things. It's even though this cutting-edge energy often is off the radar of most academia, it still attracts quite a few highbrow people, and they show up at these conferences and sometimes participate, sometimes just sit in the audience and listen and take notes. So anyway, it's a fantastic conference. You have a great lineup of speakers, and some of them are the same from 1 year to the next, but you have new speakers each year as well.
Well, I try to limit to about maybe 30% carryover speakers, and then I try to get like another 30%, which are well-known speakers, and then another 30%, which are totally unknown people. And that's kind of like the formula we use. This year, we're going to be trying to get a magnetic motor. You know, there's at least three, maybe four people out there with a magnetic motor. That's Butch LaFont and Paul Sprain and Leslie Snyder. And then you have the Stern Group in Ireland. And I'm trying to contact them to see if we can't get one of those motors here. I tried last year, and there was no takers, and maybe this year.
Butch LaFont has a working magnet motor?
They're close. You know, he wants to wait till he gets a self-runner.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep seeing emails where they're close and they're close, you know. And Paul Sprain, he claimed to have an over-unity motor, but he wanted to wait And I'll tell you, you can get one that was self-running. And Leslie Snyder, he had the one that kind of looked like a Hamel type of motor. That was on the web last year. And Stern, that's the big mystery motor in Ireland.
Yeah. I'm quite impressed by them. What's your take on them?
I don't know enough about it. They don't release that much information.
Mm-mm.
You know, it's like it could be something proprietary that really isn't proprietary that they're trying to hide, you know, for all I know.
Mm-hmm. The Paul Sprain motor, that was kind of it's similar to what Ted Loader's working on, where you have a almost seashell-shaped periphery stator magnet configuration that starts in close and then gets further and further away, or the other way around, gets closer and closer. But you've got that break point at each 360-degree turn that you have to overcome. The motor might turn up to that point, but then you have to give it some kind of electromagnetic impulse to get it past that. So when you talk about over-unity, the idea is that the amount it takes to give it that pulse is less than the amount of energy, total energy, you're getting out of the system. And I have to be frank with you, I am not very optimistic myself that we're ever going to see that particular model work productively.
Well, I don't know about that particular model. I do know that one of the great things about electricity is that if you take and you have a spark in the vicinity of a magnet, the magnetic field will collapse temporarily. And I've seen plans based on having like a spark plug and it's time to go off just as that magnet gets close, you know, towards the lockup point, then you have that spark and then it continues on past. That to me looks, you know, that's kind of a hopeful type of motor there. I built a superconducting motor one time, but it was totally based on electromagnetics, and it had to be at time just right. But it wasn't over unity.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, it would heat up, and it ate up batteries like you wouldn't believe.
You know, of all the magnet motors I know about, despite all the bad press, I am still most hopeful about Mike Brady's design. He is not very easy to get in and verify, and he promised us back in June, I think, the New Energy Congress, to let some of us in to check him out. And he just kept putting us off. We tried to make an appointment, and he's still putting us off. He's in the middle of moving to another facility outside of Munich. And he said that when he gets all settled in, he'll let us in and see what he's got. He supposedly has a 300-kilowatt electromagnetic system. It started as a purely magnet motor, you know, with magnets repelling magnets. And we've got video footage of that on our website. It's not skeptic-proof. But his electromagnetic version apparently, or supposedly, uses the same principle, but rather than magnet repelling magnet, he uses electromagnets to accentuate and optimize the timing. And so allegedly he's got the 300 kilowatt unit for sale, and he says that he's been building them at about 20 a month. He's had about 20 installed in homes, and a lot of interesting claims that we've not been able to back up or validate.
Well, you know, and that's the frustrating thing is being able to back up this stuff. Like you had the Minato motor when that was supposed to be a magnetic type of motor used by a fan, and there's supposed to be all these thousands of fans sold in the department store there in Japan, and I have yet to see one.
Mm-hmm.
You would have thought that someone somewhere would have brought one to one of these conferences.
Yeah.
So, like I say, you know, that's why we have the conferences, seeing is believing. All these people are out here talking, and what we try to do is get people with hardware and get them to bring the hardware. Yeah.
Well, talking about seeing is believing, there have been a lot of technologies out there people claiming they have this or that over Unity or some kind of a system that's going to make oil obsolete as a fuel source, and yet none of these have yet penetrated the market. I'm curious, in the 22 years you've been involved in this, what has been your personal eyewitness experience with technologies?
Well, I helped build a motor that, from a conventional engineering viewpoint, and I am an electrical engineer by degree, and I worked in aerospace for about 10 years, okay? So I do have a lot of practical experience in this area. And this motor should not have worked. You know, it's totally impossible. But yet it did. And it was a very simple one called the Kipper motor. We give the plans out free to our members who request them over the web. And it was a very simple alternator driven by a small DC motor. And I've seen this thing work. I've seen it take a dead battery from 9 volts, barely able to turn this thing, all of a sudden just pick up speed and charge that battery to 14 volts. We put on a 120-watt lamp, do an inverter to soak up some more energy because I was afraid it was going to blow up the battery, and it worked for 3 weeks and then died.
Yeah.
Then we had the Asian provocateurs come in, you know, the men in black, so to speak, and they lured the inventor there, Kipper, away, telling them, "Don't help Steve, don't help Steve, we'll make you a millionaire." And instead they set him up, and I've been in recent contact with him this last year, and once he gets to the time, I want to run down there to where he lives. He lives in the middle of nowhere, and we're going to work on some of this again, you know. But he said he's built bigger models with these other people, but they were never able to break the three-week barrier for some reason. There's a three-week thing going on here, and we don't know what it is.
This one that you helped build and you observed for 3 weeks, was this at your home under your observation, or where was that?
Yeah. Built it there. I helped build it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It took us all about maybe 10 or 15 minutes to build the thing. You know, and I'm just going all the while, this ain't going to work, there's no way this can work, you know. And I had to pick my jaw off the floor. I still can't believe it, you know. But
so it sat there in your house for 3 weeks and ran?
Ran in the middle. When we turned it on, it would come on and just take off. No problems.
Now, was it 3 weeks continuous or 3 weeks off and on?
Off and on. You know, because I didn't want to leave the thing running when I was sleeping because, you know, anything can happen.
Mm-hmm. What kind of, it was putting out electricity or torque? How are you harnessing the energy?
It's putting out electricity. We measure 3 amps going into the motor. We measure 30 amps coming out of the alternator. And like I said, you know, we charged the battery within 2 hours. You know, it was just unbelievable.
So as you turn this thing on, what was your load?
Whatever we had hooked up. I mean,
mm-hmm.
At first, no, we had just the battery, but the battery was dead. It could just barely turn the 3-amp motor there. And I've had to kind of, you know, take and spin the alternator to get over that heater going. And Kip predicted, so this thing, right, he comes, he bounces, hits the wires with his hands, then all of a sudden that thing just, you know, picked up speed. Now, meters can fool you. People can play games with meters, and you might not pick it up. But the one thing you can't fool with is the amount of energy it takes to spin an alternator, you know? The thing picked up speed, you know? And that's what I found was truly incredible. And we figured it was tapping to the zero-point energy somehow. And I believe that it may be a 6-foot wavelength associated with that energy.
Now, as you know, I did a story about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years, by somebody who claimed that this Kipper motor was actually a parlor trick, so to speak, that Kipper had some kind of microwave energy that he was wirelessly inducing these coils, and that as he would, you know, turn it on, turn it off, his wife would be turning on the distant source, and it was being beamed into the device and making it go or turn it off and on. He took some trips around Kipper's property and found a tower nearby that was suspect in terms of a possible wireless transmitter of the technology. And he also did some testing himself where he took some coils that had been used by Kipper in a microwave, turned the microwave on, and they immediately picked up the energy. Fairly convincing argument that whole thing was a fraud. What would be your response to that?
I would say the guy's full of it. I mean, think about it. You know, first of all, this was done in my shop.
Mm-hmm.
Kipper has no access to my shop when I'm not there. And I'm there 24 hours a day. And if I'm not there, there's someone else there. So there's nothing inside the shop itself. Now, if he would have put some kind of source in his pickup truck, because he has a small pickup truck, okay, the only place he could have put it would have been under the hood. For him to put something that could put out that much power underneath the hood that would get through a wall and about a good 100 feet there, that's a pretty powerful system. I don't think he could put one underneath the hood, you know.
So this 3 amps in, 30 amps out, you're convinced...
At 12 volts.
At 12 volts. That's a lot of energy. You're convinced that there was something to that. And you have plans for this on your site. Has anyone been able to take those plans and replicate the effect?
There's a gentleman one time who did. And his only lasted 3 days, though. But it just blew him away. And he had put on the back burner to get some products out the door, you know, because he has to make a living. And before he could get back to it, he died of a heart attack. But he was like 84 years old, so.
So you wouldn't consider that suspicious?
Any of us can drop dead of a heart attack. It can happen anytime, any place, you know. It doesn't have to necessarily be diabolical, you know.
You said it took you 10 to 15 minutes to build this thing. It sounds like it's easy to assemble. It seems a little bit odd that something is so simple would be so evasive to replicate.
It's a matter of tuning. I'm sure of it. I think it has to be at just the right wavelength, you know. And Kipper, you know, he's one of these people who have a gift, okay. And he can feel things, you know, you can see it. Strange things can happen around this guy. So I don't think that it's a matter of he was being a fraud or anything. It's just that he was very good at tuning these devices, you know, intuitively.
What's he doing nowadays?
I have no idea. The guy lives, like I say, in the outback here of Arizona, in a place where there are no marked roads. You just kind of have to know where you're going to get to his place. And I haven't, the last I heard, he was working like at Circle K as a clerk, you know, just to make a few bucks here and there. He doesn't need the money, too much money to survive on out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole point. Yeah. And I know that there is no electrical lines going to his place. And there are no telephone lines out there. and cell phone is very, very spotty. It's like in my house, you know, if you're standing by this, I have wires going through my property now, and you stand by the pole and you can get a signal, but no one else in town can get a signal. So it's real spotty out here when you're in the middle of nowhere.
You've been to his place?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So somebody with this kind of technology, you say some, quote, men in black came along. Why did you call them men in black?
Because the men in black are very disruptive forces. Anything that when you try to do this stuff, you know, you always seem to attract visitors. I just call them men in black. It's a pretty generic term. Whether they're from a government or private industry, it really doesn't matter. They're still obstructionists.
Well, there's different types of obstruction. There's well-meaning people who come along, want to make a difference, and they're either incompetent or they don't have a vision or whatever. They end up mucking things up, and it's not because they're evil, you know, defining people working for some oil company. It's just incompetence and it's human attributes, personalities that can't get along. Would you ascribe what happened as an overt, from the outset, intention to distract or to derail this process, or was it a well-meaning, gone awry type of process?
I think they were trying to take it over. You know,
well,
capitalize
trying to take
on
it over.
So,
and monopolize is not necessarily born of an evil intent. It's just somebody who thinks they can do better than somebody else and wants to step in and make it work. I wouldn't call that a men in black influence.
Well, I don't know. Men in black come in many sizes and shapes and forms, you know. I don't trust anyone, you know. I got that pretty hard myself, you know. One time, by these people who were posing as a camera crew, you know. Yet all the time, you know, they were putting devices around me, which made me very ill. And I'm pretty sure it was the camera crew, because they're the only ones who didn't belong there. So, men in black, it's a very generic term for any type of obstructionist, you know, without getting into the UFO circles and that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm curious, you know, you've got these plans for this Kipper device available on your website, and again, that's teslatech.info.
Right. And what they do is they're Freedom members, you know, and they just send me an email, and we had to revamp our website this year, and we still haven't gotten all the forms, you know, so just drop me an email, I can deal with it.
So I'm just curious, over the years, how many people have gotten these plans, how many people have attempted to build this thing?
I sent out 20 or 30 myself. We also put it in our magazine at one point. And so, a lot of times people do stuff and they don't report back.
Mm-hmm.
They may have taken part of it, seen something work, and run with it, and they don't tell you. People in this field are very, very secretive for good reason.
Well, let's talk about other devices. We've talked about the Kipper device. Is there another device you've personally seen that, in your opinion, was harnessing some kind of unseen new energy source?
Well, you have a gate device. I know a lot of people are familiar with that. And that is a plasma-generated device, and MIT is using this thing called Plasmatron. I have DVDs right now of Paul Pantone demonstrating it back in 95, you know, his original gate device. I have one of these. I've run on everything Paul's running on, you know, like, you know, the Pepsi, the juice, you know, the whole works, you know, bit. I'm convinced it works. I've demonstrated without Paul even being around there, you know, so it's nothing to do with him as far as an inventor influencing anything. But yet, you know, there's people who insist it don't work, you know. Most of the time I find that when it doesn't work, is people have added stuff to it. I've seen people have a lot of vacuum leaks, you know, and haven't been able to get their leaks taken care of. Or they use a broken down engine to begin with. You know.
When you talk about a plasma generating device,
right.
This is a fuel enhancement technology, correct?
Pardon?
What you're talking about?
Well, it's really not a fuel enhancement because basically what it's doing is it's putting a fuel, whether it be a fossil fuel or a junk fuel, you know, like I say, it's grape juice or something, taking it in a vapor form and stripping out its chemical configuration, you know, like if it was a hydrocarbon, it'd be breaking all the everything down into hydrogen and carbons and oxygen. One of the unique things about this thing is once you get it hot and running, you have to cut off the air intake. You don't want any air to come in that's not with that vapor to begin with. And I haven't really had a problem. It's exactly opposite of what you'd expect to see an engine do. And that there, you know, I was dressed down in class one time, you know, because, you know, I talked about a low temperature plasma here. I'm told, well, you can't have a plasma at low temperatures like an automobile engine. And the GEET is a perfect example where it's possible. And now it's being confirmed by MIT with their plasma trial. They're talking about it.
That was just 2-3 months ago, wasn't it?
They came out with theirs in 99. Our biggest problem right now is that, unfortunately, Mr. Fantone is incarcerated. And we're going to have a good article about the whole issues that's involved with Paul and his current position, as well as with the GEET device in our next issue.
That'd be good. Now, I was talking to somebody yesterday, and we were doing some brainstorming that seems it may be relevant here to the GEET. You're familiar with Santilli's magna gas, where he's taken a high-intensity arc, passing a waste through it, a waste stream such as sewage, and it breaks down the molecules into their elemental components. And then what happens in the high-intensity field is these, you take two atoms, for example, that their electron shells are warped because of the magnetic field that is a local magnetic field that's created in the arc. And you get multiple atoms actually sticking together magnetically, and as they emerge from this arc, they are then adhere to each other magnetically, not molecularly. So he calls these magnacules, and the gas is called magna gas, and it has some very unusual and interesting properties that he's been able to demonstrate through various scientific processes. He's a PhD scientist and has done a lot of rigorous research on this. There's been about 100 scientists from around the world that are pursuing this. Well, the guy I was talking to yesterday, a new member of the New Energy Congress, his name is Noah Seedman. He actually postulates that the Brown's gas technology, the electrolysis process, may be doing a similar thing, even though there's not the high-intensity arc. The creation of the gases may be similar to the magna gas. And I'm wondering if maybe the GEET process isn't doing the same thing.
Well, I'm sure it's doing something very similar, except that instead of using electricity from an external source, as it's drawing this fuel or this vapor down this tube, right, it's generating its own electric field. Because anytime you have two dissimilar materials, you know, rubbing each other, you're going to generate electricity. And that also shows up as that magnetic field, you know, how the rod gets magnetized. That's an offshoot of that. And because Paul has that rod inside of a tube, all of a sudden you get the Venturi effect, which magnifies the vacuum and at the same time intensifies the speed and therefore intensifies the field. And you get like a twisting effect, and it shows up on his reaction chamber with a spike right dead center, which is kind of interesting. If you know anything about Fourier transformers and everything, you know how impulses will turn around and show up somewhere else, you know, as like a pulse, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, by the time it gets to the exhaust, you put your hand on exhaust, you know, and if you can't put your hand on it, you don't have a tuned engine. It's not doing right.
Cool?
It's not right.
It's not hotter or super hot. It's you can touch it.
Yeah, if it's running properly and you don't have any vacuum leaks, you know, and you should not ever get a hot exhaust with a GEET device. All that energy goes into that reactor.
The GEET has been around for quite a few years, and it seems to have more traction over in Europe than here in the United States. And I'm curious, I think a month ago or so, there's a report we posted in our news about somebody who was flying a helicopter employing the GEET process. Now, isn't the net effect, I asked earlier if this was a fuel enhancement situation, and you were saying it's not. But as far as the layman is concerned, your engine is still running on fossil fuels, and you're able to improve your mileage. So you, rather than getting 13 miles a gallon, maybe you're getting 20 or 25. On a practical level, what is the GEET doing? And so basically a two-part question. What does the GEET technology do? And is it being implemented in a practical work-a-day type of situation right now?
Well, a lot of the current research is kind of on hold right now because of Paul's situation. But GEET, when you use fossil fuels, will get you, will allow things to run longer and with less pollution. However, the great benefit is you don't need to use fossil fuels. It would take just about anything. You had this chemical problem up in Salt Lake City. I can't remember the chemical that was being dumped. But the GEET device will take that same material, run their engines, put out electricity, and get rid of the pollution problem. But yet, they don't want nothing to do with it. It could be because of Paul. Yeah, or could be
the MagCor.
Yeah, I think it's MagCor, whatever.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest polluters in the United States.
And they don't want anything to do with it. And I tell you what, when you start messing with toxic waste and everything, you know, you're getting some areas which is basically mafia run. You know, and it's shocking the people that are involved there.
Now, you're saying that it makes the engine run longer. I guess, in other words, are you getting more a distance for the same amount of fuel, which equates to an improved fuel economy?
You can get either improved mileage if it's used like in a car, but if you use it in a stationary mode, like on a generator, that you get longer run times. And basically that was what Paul was on at one point, was generators or gensets.
Let's talk about another technology that you've had personal interaction with.
Okay. Well, I haven't had it yet, but I'm planning to get this. I'm trying to get the Mighty engine to show up at the conference. That would be
the
32-cylinder engine.
Mm-hmm.
Which puts the power of a Cummins diesel into your hands, and something the size of your hand. We're going to do some anti-gravity stuff with Harvey Seal again. That would be John's father. And we may get some Otis car material and possibly some Dean motor material. Those are all in inertial propulsion devices or anti-gravity devices.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this Mighty But Tiny for a little while. That's a fairly well-established and well-documented technology, I would say it's closer to mainstream than these other two that you just mentioned. Would you agree with that assessment?
It's closer to the mainstream in that it uses fossil fuels in that, but it's totally radical in how he arranges the cylinder in a circular configuration. So it's almost like, I would say it's almost like having a little turbine there, and the blade of each turbine is being propelled. You know what I'm getting at?
Not quite.
It's pushing it around in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having six main cylinders that are on a crankshaft, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
Here you have it on the circumference of the engine.
What kind of improvement in efficiency are you getting with that mighty but tiny engine?
Well, you're going from like about a 3,000-pound Cummins engine to something that probably weighs less than 100 pounds. You're getting the same amount of horsepower out of it. That's a pretty substantial improvement. It could really have the most potential to change the dynamics of the transportation system as we know it.
In addition to decreasing the size, which of course makes things more efficient because you don't have, both don't have to get this big, clunky, heavy engine turning, and you don't have the weight of the engine in your car, so that's going to contribute to fuel savings in fuel. But also, isn't the system itself let's say you have your 300-pound Cummins running and you have your 100-pound mighty yet tiny engine running, what is the rate of fuel consumption per that same horsepower output?
The mighty engine uses a lot less.
By how much?
I can't tell you right off the bat. I don't have my magazine in front of me. But we have all the information in our... I think it was two issues back.
You see this picture where he's standing in front of a big honking engine on the right-hand side, and then to his left is this little tiny thing that is just minuscule in comparison. It's really a dramatic illustration. I've also seen some video footage of him doing his system at a trade show. It seems like he's really got a lot of documentation, scientific university types of documentation up his sleeve, doesn't he?
Pardon me, I just got the information we were looking for, Sterling.
Okay.
Okay, a Cummins engine is a 3,000-pound engine.
Mm-hmm.
It has 855 cubic inches of displacement. The mighty engine weighs approximately 150 pounds, and displaces 850 cubic inches. So, right there, you're going to have the increase in efficiency that's just due to the weight you don't have to carry around with you. If you're looking at a car engine, a four-cylinder, 80 cubic inch, weighs about 200 pounds. So it's even less than that. Puts out 10 times the energy. We hope to get this engine at our conference. I'll be working on getting the speakers after the new year here, and we hope to have a program ready by the end of February.
Is that something you could do indoors where you've got your emissions and you've got an enclosed room?
Well, all you have to do is just run an exhaust hose out the door.
Okay. Yeah, you do have a door that goes to the outside there. Interesting. Well, let's talk about this anti-gravity stuff. What's that about?
Okay, well, you have Harvey, and he's did a presentation at our last conference, and he had a feature article in our last issue of our magazine, which came out a couple weeks ago. And he's promised me to come to the next conference with actual working hardware. He uses a device that is constantly off balance. And it's off balance in one direction. So as when it's running, it's going to be moving in one direction only. That's what they call inertial displacement. There have been a lot of different devices over the year. If you could ever get one of these to work, it would eliminate the need for a transmission because the box, you know, will prepare you in the way you want to go. If you turn a vertical position, it would actually lift off the ground. In our 2001 conference, we had a gentleman by the name of Jim Cox, and he has been working on this for 20 years. He used to have an anti-gravity newsletter, and he used to put on anti-gravity conferences. And he says, though, that the only one that works is a Dean machine. And I'm hoping to get him there this year, and he can explain what a Dean machine in more detail.
In your magazine, was this the article where you had a gentleman standing on a platform of sorts with a handlebar coming up?
No, that was Dan Davidson. And what Dan has done is, I guess this Russian guy discovered that if you could take the wings of a beetle,
mm-hmm.
and the bottom of that platform are beetle wings, okay? I guess the inner wings coat the one layer, and then he has like another sliding layer that slides over it, and that would be the outer thing of beetle wings. And it appears that beetles can't fly like a regular insect does. It's actually an anti-gravity effect. And this guy purportedly claims that they had lifted off the ground using this device and no other energy. And that's something I have to see to believe, you know, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the whole theory, and it's one of nature's way, a natural anti-gravity effect that you see.
In terms of the scientific literature, do they present the beetle wing as an enigma that they don't understand how they fly?
Right. Yeah. They can't fly using their wings. They're not configured for that. As far as like the way we think, where you flap, you know, and you move the air fast enough, it's really not set up like that. And if you do a computer program at one point, you know, they said, you know, bumblebees can't fly according to a computer, yet they do.
On the KeeleyNet website, I think there's a picture, that same image that you had in your magazine this last issue. He has it on the top of his, top or bottom of his KeeleyNet.com site. It's a permanent part of his news page. That's the guy standing on the platform. You're saying this is the one that's using this beetle wing
right.
principle?
Right, that's using the beetle wings. See, one of the things, you know, in through all history, scientists would observe nature and try to imitate nature. It's only in the since the 1900s, okay, that we have gotten away from that, and we use these equations and that to try to describe things, and we try to master nature and not work with nature and don't observe what nature is doing. And I think that we've gone off the deep end with that respect. And that's one of the things our magazine is trying to focus on and bring to people's attention is what true science research should be. Observing, you know, then making the theories, then doing it, and then performing an experiment, but always working with nature, not trying to control it so much, you know, like we do. We're trying to be the master of it. And we're not doing too good of a job.
You used a term earlier in the interview, zero-point energy. And as far as I know, I mean, it seems that in people in trying to describe why or how something is working that they don't understand, there's a tendency in this field for people to just call it zero-point energy as somewhat of a catch-all phrase for anything we don't understand. Would you agree with that?
Yes and no. Some people do, and serious scientists know what they're talking about. And there's probably different types of definitions for zero-point energy. When I refer to zero-point energy, I'm referring to like when you have electromagnetic field that's been kind of canceled out. You know, there still has to be that tension there somehow, some way that manifests itself, okay? And although you don't measure it on a regular electrical measuring device like a voltmeter and that. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that that energy is not there. You know, and there has to be a tension there. It's kind of like if you have a string and it's being pulled on both ends taut, right? And the energy is balanced, right, so that it's not going nowhere. Then you can't really measure it. It's called zero, right? But if all of a sudden someone is let go, it snaps out of there. The tension is still there. You know, it's just a way of trying to figure out how to use it. And that's kind of what, you know, my concept of what the zero point's all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all your traditional electromagnetic vectors equal zero. But there's still a tension there, has to be, you know, physically. Except, like, everything's balanced. And the trick is to unbalance it and use it.
In the 22 years that you've been pursuing this technology and playing a leadership role in terms of reporting and organizing, highlighting certain technologies, promoting awareness, who would you say, or what organization nowadays, research organization, is the closest thing to Nikola Tesla? You call your website teslatech.info, and obviously Tesla is somewhat of a poster child in all of the things that you feature. I'm just curious, from your perspective, who's the closest to, or is there anyone that is close to achieving some of the really miraculous, miraculous is only a relative term. It's when you don't understand what's going on, it seems miraculous. But some of the later work of Nikola Tesla that didn't get integrated, the AC was integrated, his earlier work was integrated, but his later work kept pushing the envelope, was too much then and may even still be too much now for us to really understand and comprehend. But obviously there are people who are trying to. Who's the closest? I mean, who are some groups and individuals that should be keeping an eye on?
Depends on what you're looking at for. You know, like if you're looking for turbines, you've got the Tesla Engine Builders Association. You know, Jeff Hayes was at our conference last year. And he'd be he's done a lot of research himself, and he's in contact with all these other people. There's Bill Weishaupt, you know, on Tesla Coils and Magnifying Transmitters. You have Bill Weishaupt and the Tesla Coil Builders of Richmond, you know, Richard Hull's group, you know, out there. And you have Drilling Cox. All those are great Tesla Coil researchers. And they do physical work. The Quorum brothers, you know, Jim Quorum and his brother Ken. Jim was a professor at the University of West Virginia and Battelle Research Lab. And they were able to duplicate a lot of Tesla's work. And the biggest problem that they found with Tesla was that people would say the technology and the series didn't work, but then again, they weren't following Tesla's instructions to the letter. And when every time they did, they would find that Tesla was absolutely correct in what he observed. You know.
Now, there is some, you know, it wasn't like Tesla was exactly easy to understand. He purposely wrote things enigmatically to get his patent but protect the idea, from what I understand.
I don't know if an enigmatic would be the word for it, or if it's just that the terms he used are so different than what we use today. For instance, do you know what a coherer is?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I dare say probably about 95% of the engineers out there today could not tell you what a coherer was. And basically all that is like a tube filled with like metal filings, and when you put a charge across it, it lines them up and allows the current to pass through. It was an early form of a diode. So I'm not so sure it's not what Tesla wrote so much as our understanding of the English language today as opposed to how it was used 100 years ago. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, one of the things that we've not talked about that you feature both in your magazine and in the conferences is a health aspect. Electromagnetic devices that are applied to health. Care to comment on that, I guess, genre or that particular field?
Well, yeah, electromagnetic, you know, plays a big part in health. Tesla worked with Darsonval back in the 1890s, established in the field of bioelectricity and the effect electricity would have on living organisms. And Tesla was the first one to run high-frequency currents over people's bodies without harm. In some ways, he had to do that out of self-defense because Edison, his competitor, was trying to paint alternating current as the death current. And in fact, he was able to invent the electric chair and have it used in New York there in order to show people how dangerous alternating current was. That was Edison. And Tesla, in defense, developed, you know, high-frequency currents and showed that he could pass them over his body without harm. And so we know that electricity affects things. And at the turn of the century, you know, the violet ray, which is an offshoot of the Tesla coil, was a universal tool. You know, it was as common as, I don't know, aspirin is the doctors today, you know, as far as being used, okay? It's just a very common device that you don't see it today. I cover a lot of the health aspects in my magazine because I think, you know, our researchers won't get a lot of this information any other way because a lot of guys will not pick up a health magazine on their own. And yet, we die from ignorance. Like right now, you know, I have a cholesterol problem, so they say, you know, my cholesterol is way up there. And they want to put me on this Lipitor and everything, and I told them where they can go with that. I'm taking it down in other ways, you know, like on Atrovac, with red yeast and that. But Lipitor now, it turns out, as in October, breaks down the muscles that hold your skeleton together. And people are going to be in big problems because of that. You know, it's a hidden problem, and there's millions of people taking Lipitor. You know. So, this is my way of helping the world out and making it a better place, and it's very Tesla-related, because Tesla was very concerned about his health. You know, he washed his hands constantly, because he almost died of, I can't remember, a cholera. He almost died of cholera when he was a kid. So once you face death from germs, you know, you don't want to, you know, you're always aware of them from that point on.
Mm-hmm. How many of the devices, didn't he have some 700-plus patents? How many of those were health-related devices?
I couldn't give you a count on the number of health-related devices, but, like, you have the ozone machine. That could be considered one for health. He had the Tesla coil, which was later converted over into it. Tesla didn't focus on the health aspect so much as he was interested in just the physics behind it.
Mm-hmm. Have you watched the recent movie Prestige, The Prestige?
No, I haven't.
You got to watch that. It's really good. Tesla is depicted as a genius, kind of as a subplot of the movie, and actually gets quite a bit of time in this. It was a best-selling movie the week it came out. So you want to see that. It's really good. Well, we are at the end of our time. Is there any final thoughts you want to throw in there that we've not covered?
If anyone is interested in coming to our conference next year, they need to check out, keep checking our website, www.teslatech.info. Make sure you go to .info, Tesla Tech, TESLATECH.info. We are giving 35% off to anyone who signs up before December 31st. That's only like about a week away.
That's for members, right?
Right. And it's $30 a year to be a member, and you get our magazine. And we have specials going on all the time. And soon we'll have the Global Science videos up for sale up there. And we're looking for a great year this year. Last year was great. This year is going to be even better.
Well, Steve, thanks for joining us. This has been Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us every day at freeenergynews.com. Thank you.